Hey, this is Ari Lehman, the first Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th, and I'm inviting you all to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Friday the 13th with my good friends at the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Jason is watching, so download or die.
Morning live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning head turning ass kicking machismo dripping master podcast and mouthpiece of the southeast, Brandon A. Lane, bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Now in May, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of Friday the 13th, but we're going to have to jump the gun because we actually have a Friday the 13th this very month. And who better to celebrate this monumental occasion with than the man you heard at the top of this episode, the original Jason Voorhees himself, Ari Lehman. Now, as a massive thank you, and as a huge fan of him and his band First Jason, I want all of you out there in the Rant Army to follow Ari on Twitter at First Jason. Thank you, Ari. Can't thank you enough. Now, once you've followed him, you gotta do the same for us. The Rants from the Black Lodge podcast can be found on social media at Rants Black Lodge. Subscribe to the podcast on one of the many platforms we're available on, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio, and don't you for a second forget to stop by our homepage at JuicyKruger.com, and for the love of Cthulhu, buy a t-shirt in our web store at RantArmy.com. Now, when we come back, we're going to deep dive into the blood-soaked waters of Crystal Lake. But first, here's some messages from our sponsors.
Hey, assholes! It's me, Boner the Skeleton, mascot of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Here to sell you some shit you probably can't afford. Are you low on cash? That's not a problem. Sell your children. Sell your blood. Go to the jack-off clinic and give them a sperm sample. We don't care how you get the money, as long as you give it to us. Want a t-shirt? Want a sticker or a mug to show that you're a true friend and a member of the Rant Army? Well, guess what? Go to Rant Army Surplus. The link is in the description. And if you don't buy something, then fuck you.
The date of Friday the 13th may signify all things unlucky for most, but I am beyond fortunate on this hallowed occasion to be basking in 40 years of awesome slasher movie mayhem from the hands of Mrs. Voorhees and her baby boy. That's right, tonight we're going to be dissecting the 1980 original and one of the best and memorable slasher films of all time, Friday the 13th. So let's just hit the ground running. Friday the 13th was released May 9th, 1980 on a small budget of $700,000. Its gross was $5.9 million. That is a huge, huge profit. Now, putting those figures into the lens of inflation for the year 2020 that we're currently in, it would be a budget of $2 million and a gross of $18 million. Like, if you even look at it in that format, $2 million is nothing. Like, there are commercials that cost more than that now. So this is it's insane that this thing has had the life, the longevity, and the impact that it's had over the years. However, were the film going public, absolutely ate that shit up. The critics were not so, they were not so kind to it. Now, we're going to dissect those aspects a little later in the podcast, but first, let's take a more of a modern view on how the film going public, or more, should I say, the trolls that live behind them view it. And I'm actually surprised, because Friday the 13th has higher reviews than I thought it would have. IMDb has it at a 6.5 out of 10. I think that's fair. Metacritic, unfortunately, at odds with how I see things, at a 22 out of 100. That's just fucking ridiculous. Metacritic, fuck you. Rotten Tomatoes has a tomato score of 62%. That's actually higher than I thought it would be, so kudos, Rotten Tomatoes. Unfortunately, the audience score is 61%, which I thought would be higher. So I'm going to talk shit to the fans for a change. Come on, get with it. Friday the 13th, it's an all-time classic. Google users, who I most often agree with, well, they have it at an 89%. Now, I will agree, I think that may be a tad bit too high, and we're going to talk at length to the pros and the cons of this film as we continue on, but it's not a perfect film, and I think even the most diehard fans can realize that. I would put it at 85%, so if you value my score on it, that's what it would be. Fat Tony's hit list for Friday the 13th has our kill count at 10. Not too bad for a proto-slasher film, the one that kind of set everything in motion. That comes out to be one kill every 9.5 minutes. Now, there's a lot of padding in this movie, but still pretty blood-soaked, considering this is before the, you know, kill every 20 seconds kind of slasher film that would come later in the decade. Stank Dick Eddie's Titty Tally is Friday the 13th. He kind of let me down on this one. Only one set of bare breasts in this film. I had lied to myself internally. I thought there was more, but there's only one. And that is of the lovely Marcy, played by Janine Taylor. We're going to be talking about her a little later on. Before we can properly examine the film in question, we have to chronicle the events that led to its inception. So let's take it from page to screen. In the early 1970s, Connecticut-based filmmaker Sean S. Cunningham was struggling to make a name for himself in the world of film, scraping by on a diet of industrial shorts, commercials, and even the occasional softcore porno. It was a different time. However, Sean's big screen aspirations would initially come in the form of two family-friendly films. Writer Victor Miller had this to say about the duo's foray into the kids' film market. In the mid-70s, everybody said we need to make nice, clean, wholesome films. So we did. Two very nice, clean, wholesome films. And they made absolutely $0. Now, low-budget filmmaking would be a high-risk endeavor, so Sean quickly saw the writing on the wall and knew a change in course was necessary for financial success. Sean had this to say about shifting to the horror genre. Now I had to get another job. Somehow or another, I had to get something going. Now, that something turned out to be 1972's unsettling classic Last House on the Left. Now, the film was produced by Cunningham, and it was directed by legendary horror meister Wes Craven. You know, Hills Have Eyes, Nightmare on Elm Street, Shocker, on down the line. And it presented a brutal portrait of violence and visceral horror in a small-town America. With a cult horror behemoth under his belt, he set his sights on mainstream success with his next brainchild, with a considerable debt to John Carpenter's 1978 classic Halloween. Let's just call a spade a spade. Although Halloween is not the first slasher film, it's definitely the one that probably lit the ignition on the whole boom. But Friday the 13th was the dynamite, so let's keep that in mind. Now, between Halloween, Black Christmas, and Prom Night, and the original Friday the 13th, this would birth this new subgenre of horror, the slasher film, that we all know and love. In the early 1980s, Friday the 13th was picked up for distribution by Frank Mancuso Sr. Now, his son would go on to be very instrumental in the sequels, but Sr. is the one who had, you know, all the to-do with this film. He was the VP of Paramount at the time, and he planned a nationwide release and a multi-million dollar marketing campaign. This is important because this has never been done before for basically a independent film. So it had a stage and a presentation that no other slasher film had gotten. You got to think, like, how big would have Halloween been had it been a national wide release? Arguably a better made film, but I mean, let's just not get down in the dirt. They're both great for different reasons. This risk paid off in spades. Friday the 13th knocked off The Empire Strikes Back at the number one spot at the box office, as in Star Wars Part 2, before there were prequels and sequels and spinoffs. The second Star Wars film, which is arguably the best of the genre, in fact, here in the Black Lodge, I have it, the poster autographed by a good deal of the people who worked and participated with the film. I hold it in dear, dear place in my heart and in the hallowed halls of, you know, fantasy, science fiction, action, and all those things. But Friday the 13th, this little movie knocked off one of the biggest films of all time from the number one spot. So that shows you, man, the public's appetite for horror was just knocking on all cylinders at this point. And here we are, 40 years later. Friday the 13th is a slasher movie that is held in the prestige of, you know, royalty. It boasts 12 films, a TV spinoff, toys, comics, t-shirts, and video games. But we're not here to talk about all that. We're here to talk about the original film. So let's read the synopsis. A group of camp counselors are stalked and murdered by an unknown assailant while trying to reopen a summer camp, where years before it was a site of a child's drowning and a grisly double murder. We have to view art through the lens of the artist who made it happen. So oftentimes when we do these dissections in this podcast, we either start with the writer or the director. I think it's only fitting that we start with the director, and that being Sean S. Cunningham. He's done a few things that you may be familiar with. He did A Stranger Is Watching, Deep Star 6, The New Kids with James Spader, who was in Baby Boom with Harold Ramis, who was in Ghostbusters, You Just Got Busted. There's going to be a few of those, so get used to it. Those films aside, Friday the 13th is his claim to fame, and it started with a title. Sean had this to say, I had thought of this title some time ago, Friday the 13th, and I said to myself, if I had a film called Friday the 13th, I could sell that. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take out and add in variety, and we're going to put at the top, from the people who brought you Last House on the Left comes the most terrifying film ever made, Friday the 13th. And that's what we had. We really didn't know what we were going to make. We just wanted to see if anybody was interested in buying it. Sell it, they did, but on a shoestring budget. Sean had this to say about the budgetary restrictions that he and the crew were under. When I decided to make Friday the 13th, my job was to figure out how to make something scary for very little money and very little production value. So, Friday the 13th is a very utilitarian endeavor as far as direction is concerned. Let's use Halloween as an example. They're sort of like the Black Sabbath and Judas Priest of this, you know, one created the genre, but one isn't really the genre. But here's the thing. Black Sabbath is Halloween. It's the thing that existed before the genre, and in a lot of ways it's better because it's experimental, it broke boundaries, its sound is different. In the case of Halloween, it was filmed much better. Friday the 13th is Judas Priest. It strips away, you know, the suspense, and or in the case of Black Sabbath would be the blues, and has a more direct, to-the-point thing. So, where I would argue that Friday the 13th is still a very suspenseful movie, it's not aesthetically pleasing in the way that Halloween is. There's a lot of just wide shots, establishing shots, very little camera movement, and I don't take pleasure in necessarily calling Sean Cunningham a bad director, because I don't think he necessarily is one, but I definitely wouldn't call him a great director. And John Carpenter absolutely is a great director. In fact, he's my all-time favorite director. So I think Sean had some shortcomings with that. I'll be the first to admit, you know, Sean's directing talents aren't anything special, but he did find a better niche suited for him in the form of a producer, and he produced several things you've probably heard of. He produced Last House on the Left, which we just mentioned with Wes Craven, House 1, 2, 3, and 4. At least two of those films are worth watching. My Boyfriend's Back, shout out to Adam Marcus, who almost directed that, and he produced all of the Friday the 13th sequels from the early 90s today, so pretty much all the New Line movies that, you know, some people are kind of split on. We're going to dissect the pros and cons of Sean being the gatekeeper for Friday the 13th in the series a little later in this episode, but first we have to speak about the other creative force behind the original film. So, Sean was able to secure funding for Friday the 13th through the owners of Esquire Theater Chain, who had previously funded Last House on the Left, and this collaboration would surely yield a massive box office, and it did, but first the script had to be written. The film was written by Victor Miller. Aside from Friday the 13th and some one-off re-teamings with Sean Cunningham to pen the screenplay for A Stranger Is Watching, Victor's writing credits are mostly daytime soap operas. One Life to Live, Guiding Light, Another World, General Hospital, All My Children. You know, moms and meemaws may know him for his soap opera output, but let's give credit where credit is due. Friday the 13th. This is what he's known for. Much of the hallmarks of the series came directly from his twisted mind, one in particular being the film's setting. Victor had this to say about the film being set in a camp. The longest part of the process of creating the first Friday the 13th was figuring out the venue. I had to find some territory that was adult-free, more or less. We came up with a summer camp, and Sean said, let's go with it, and that was that. I have told this story before, probably on previous episodes, but I'll say it again just for because it's pertinent to this. As a kid, one of my all-time favorite movies was Meatballs. Now, I went to summer camp several years growing up in my elementary, middle school years, and Meatballs was absolutely the reason I wanted to go to camp, because I had this idealized version of like, oh, you're going to have the best summer of your life. There's going to be, you know, fun and a little bit of raucousness, and, you know, the adults will be away, and you'll be able to do things that you'll remember for a lifetime. And I did have good experiences at camp. However, there's a reason I stopped going to camp, and it's this film in particular. Now, I've said that this movie has had more impact on my life probably than any other with the exception of Ghostbusters. Friday the 13th may be the only movie that has actually ever scared me. I mean, like, really scared me to the point where I could not sleep. And the first time I saw this film, I was well aware of who Jason was and, you know, the hockey mask and all that stuff, but I didn't see the films in order. This is back in the days of, you know, VHS and things coming on TV. Well, I can't remember how old I was, but it was my birthday is May 14th. And we were in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, me and my family, and we were going to do laser tag and go-karts and that kind of stuff, mini golf. So it just so happened that we came in on a Friday, so it was Friday the 13th. And on USA, they had a Friday the 13th marathon. Now, I had fallen asleep, and I woke up at the very beginning of this film, and I was scared not so much that people were being killed, but by the fact that the two camp counselors who were killed at the very beginning seemed to recognize the person who was about to kill them. And in my mind, it didn't make sense because, wait a minute, why, you know, Jason's a mongoloid with a hockey mask. Why would they be so at ease with that? So I'm watching this film and the revelation of it being Miss Voorhees, spoiler alert, I'm hoping you've seen the film to this point, like really, really fucked with me. And that scene at the end, which we'll touch on a little later, I have never been that scared by a movie since, and it'll never happen again. So a lot of that credit has to go to Sean Cunningham and Victor Miller. Let's talk a little bit more about Victor. I want to refocus. Sean's silent partner, Phil Scuderi, was unsatisfied with certain elements of Victor's script. So Ron Kurz, who is also a credited writer on this film, was brought in to do a rewrite. One of the major changes in the script was the addition of Officer Dorf, played Ron Milkey, and I'm probably mispronouncing that name. Victor was unhappy with this addition of the film, and he had this to say, "The only scene I had problems with was the inclusionary scene of the motorcycle policeman, which really argued against the concept. This was a geography that was kind of off balance for the police." You know, in retrospect, I never really thought about this until I was doing research, but he does have a point. If the idea is to put these characters in a position where there is no safety net, then having a police officer kind of wander in does kind of take away from that. But it's such a memorable scene. You have Ned, you know, doing his, you know, probably racially insensitive Native American dance, and, you know, all the wonderful weed dialogue. It's fun. But I have to agree, I do think it kind of goes against the point of it. And there's a lot of padding in this film, so you could probably edit that scene out and it would help the flow a little bit. But then again, there's probably other things that should be excised before it. So take it or leave it. I could go either way. Victor and Sean, to say the least, they've had a rocky relationship, which has led to the lawsuit for ownership over Friday the 13th. By the time this episode is released, we may actually have a verdict in this. They went back to court the day before Friday the 13th in February. I think it was like February 12th, if my memory is serving correct. But I don't want to get into that. I don't want to dwell on it too much, on the specifics of the lawsuit. But we definitely had to touch base on who we believe, or who I believe, the lesser of the two evils are. Both of them, at one time or another, have divorced themselves from the series. I guess you could probably give the edge to Sean, because, I mean, he did come back a decade after the fact. But at the same time, I don't want to shit, because I actually really do enjoy Jason Goes to Hell on its own merits, and Jason X is enjoyable. It's just a flat-out comedy. But, man, there definitely wasn't the films that we all wanted. Maybe a palate cleanser in between was necessary. I'll leave that for you out there in the rant army to decide. But I do think that Victor Miller in charge of it is going to cause so many problems that I can't entirely be on board for that. My vote actually goes to Vincent DeSanti. Shout out, Vincent. You're who I think should be carrying the load on this Friday the 13th endeavor, but us fans will think we'll probably get stuck with a split bill on the whole ordeal. The bickering between Sean and Victor may be a pain to listen to, but at least the score for Friday the 13th is music to our ears. Harry Manfredini, I can't say enough nice about this guy. The soundtrack to end all soundtracks, and it's, yet again, we have to harken back to Halloween because Carpenter's score for that film is so iconic, but I think Friday the 13th is just as good, albeit probably not as memorable in an earworm kind of way. Harry did a lot of things you're probably familiar with. The Children, Wes Craven's Swamp Thing, and The Hills Have Eyes Part 2. Terrible movie, but a dog has a flashback. Worth it. Fucking worth it. Slaughter High, a really, really underrated slasher film. One of the better ones that probably should be ranked higher than it usually is. House 1, 2, and 3, and 4, which I already said, two of those films are worth watching. The original Wishmaster, and he's going to be doing the music for the upcoming movie Hanukkah, which features Sid Haig's final on-screen performance. But he's best known for Friday the 13th, and he's done most of the sequels. I mean, with the exception, I think 7 reuses some music, so there's nothing original created for it. I might be wrong on that. 8, Fred Mullen did. But yeah, for the most of the part, up until, you know, the remake, some of his stuff is in there. He had this to say about his being, you know, musically inclined. For some strange reason, I don't know, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to write film music. That may seem silly, but it's true. My mother used to let me stay up at night and watch movies, and I was late for school just about every time. I did get to watch a lot of movies on television, though, so I guess I just built up. Psycho, Spartacus, and all those things, you just can't help be impressed by the music. Harry's score for Friday the 13th, to me, is hugely underrated, and it's undeniable of the Bernard Herrmann influence. Some might even say plagiarism. I won't go that far. I think it's definitely an influence. The score has been heavily criticized for being borderline plagiarized from Psycho, from Bernard Herrmann, because of its use of violin stings. And I'd Reanimator is plagiarism. Friday the 13th is just influence. Yeah, you definitely get those things that just, it harkens back to it, but there's nothing that's so egregious to make you think like, oh, this is lifted directly from Psycho. Whereas, fuck, man, Reanimator, you could just swap those scores and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference unless you just had just seen the film. So that's my two cents on it. Harry himself has acknowledged that Bernard Herrmann comparisons that are valid. He had this to say: anybody doing music for films that tells you that they're not aware of what Bernard Herrmann did or how he wrote of what he sounds like is lying off the top of their head. Of course, I know what Herrmann sounds like. So believe me, I know when I'm in a Herrmann-esque mode. You can't help it sometimes, but one of the reason is because, damn it, he was right. There are probably a lot of composers who don't imitate Bernard Herrmann, and they're not writing anymore. They're selling insurance in Tacoma. You know, influencer plagiarism aside, the element that Harry introduces in this film that has persisted to this day is that sound effect. One of the most haunting and ripped off things ever in cinema. Which is so often fucking gotten wrong by people. Now, I work in a haunted house. That's my day job. I'm an actor, supervisor, on down the line. I can't tell you how many times in a week I'll hear someone coming in and going, ch-ch-ch. So I revel in the opportunity to correct those people. And the reason this sound effect is the way it is because of a new form of technology that was kind of coming into the scope of music and in filmmaking called an echoplex. What Harry did that was so genius is he actually lifted ideas directly from the film and incorporated it through this new piece of technology. There's this close-up shot of Betsy Palmer saying, "Killer, Mommy. Killer." So he took the K from kill and the M from mommy and put it into that echoplex, and it just kind of cycles through and it made the sound K, 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 Ma, Ma, Ma. It's so iconic. And Harry's score, it's just the film's highlight. And not to knock any of the cast, but there's also an argument that aside from just the wonderful music that he created, that the star of the movie is really the special effects by Tom Savini. And that's not knocking the music, because, we could argue for days on which one is more important. Definitely on the ends of suspense, the music is the star, but that's not what we come to slasher films for. Special effects, Tom Savini. And I could go on for hours about the feats accomplished by Mr. Savini, but I'll just have to give you the Cliff Notes version for the sake of time. Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Maniac, The Burning, The Prowler, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and Creepshow. Prior to entering the special effects film, Tom was a war photographer in Vietnam. Not a job that I would want for anybody to have, but it's a good thing, so we can kind of view the horrific nature of war through an unbiased lens, and hopefully it will prevent us from finding ourselves in these positions. And his job was to document the horrific situation that was happening to his fellow soldiers, and he also saw the opportunity to learn the inner workings of the body. He had this to say about his time in Vietnam as a war photographer. I did see a lot of firsthand anatomically correct gore, and I think the most important part of that was, if we're creating a dead body or a situation, there's a certain feeling you get from seeing it if it's the real thing. If I'm creating a gory effect and I don't get the same feeling when I saw the real stuff, I'm not satisfied. Coming off of Dawn of the Dead and moving into Friday the 13th, he had this reputation of just being, you know, a wizard, you know, and prior to him, you got guys like Dick Smith, but there was no like extensive like gore in films. That was almost a no-no. Some Herschel Gordon Lewis films were very bloody, but you know, as far as like anatomically correct gore, it just wasn't the standard. Savini's credentials were evident, so it was no brainer to hire him for the mayhem of Friday the 13th. Tom had this to say about how he got the special effects gig. Sean or somebody had seen Dawn of the Dead and said, "You gotta get this guy." And there were other makeup artists, you know, but my FX had a reputation for being more realistic. Absolutely on point. Now, as we work our way down the cast list, and we'll be revisiting the work of Mr. Savini, because we can't mention any of the characters without breaking down their infamous, you know, deaths on screen. Savini constructed many of the legendary deaths between this film and his previous work in Dawn of the Dead that he had the pick of the litter to work on whatever project he wanted to. Friday the 13th came around, he took it, and he could have came back for Friday the 13th Part 2, but he turned it down to work on 1981's The Burning, which is a terrific slasher film, and some of his best work is in that. But it kind of hurts, because I feel like he could have added a lot to Friday the 13th Part 2, which has some really good kills, but it's kind of devoid of some of the more over-the-top gore that I think the series kind of leans on. This is what he had to say about not returning for Friday the 13th Part 2. I actually turned down Friday the 13th Part 2 to do The Burning because Jason was running around in Part 2, and as you know, there is no Jason. Jason was a kid that died in the first movie, and if you watch Friday the 13th, movies past Part 1, you're stupid, because there's no Jason. There shouldn't be a Jason. This is an interesting direction that the series could have gone in. I mean, really, without Jason, is there a series? They definitely could have went the Halloween 3 route and every film be a different horror movie that takes place on Friday the 13th. But I mean, come on. Jason, that image of him coming out of the water at the end, returning in Part 2 with the sack head, and then, you know, culminating in Part 3 with the debut of the hockey mask, it's so iconic that I just can't see a film series that doesn't have Jason in it. Despite his hatred for Jason becoming the antagonist, Tom himself returned to do the special effects for the fourth film and officially divorced himself from the project by killing Jason once and for all, or until he was revived in Part 6, but that's a story for another day. The strength of any good slasher film is a likable cast of characters. Friday the 13th is no exception. Let's talk about Adrian King, who plays Alice, our protagonist. You know, aside from a couple of uncredited roles in Saturday Night Fever, Hair, and being unceremoniously killed off at the beginning of Friday the 13th Part 2, this is her major claim to fame. However, does not come without its downside. Her claim to fame came at a huge cost, because not long after Friday the 13th became a massive success, Adrian's newfound notoriety attracted a stalker. She had this to say about her ordeal. Stalking was not taken seriously back in 1980, and it wasn't something that everybody was aware aware of. I was starting to get phone calls back then. It was so easy to get phone numbers. For over a year, I didn't know who my stalker was and what happened. What happened was he befriended me. I had an ordeal with him close up at one point, which in itself was a horror movie. Eventually, I had a gun to my head and I was able to talk the fan down. I go to a lot of conventions. I've been lucky enough through this podcast and, you know, my connections going back to my newspaper days of having friended people, you know, of varying degrees in the movie and music world. There's definitely a code of conduct you have to pay with people. And it's just human decency. But being that I go to these conventions a lot, I see the line crossed constantly, and especially with women. And it's really hurtful to see somebody put themselves out there and do these fan conventions only to be negatively accosted by people. So I can really sympathize with the horrific situation she found herself in. So my point would be, like, if you meet your heroes and people you love from film, treat them like a human being. They're not your friend. They're there to sign autographs. And you know what? Maybe you'll be lucky and you'll say something, it'll catch their attention, and you'll have email or Twitter recourse with them. But don't show up at their fucking doorstep, and definitely don't fucking hold a gun to them. That's just bullshit. So we're very thankful that Alice, or Adrian King rather, survived this ordeal and has, you know, returned to the public eye as of late. You know, prior to her horrific situation she endured because of her stalker, she managed to craft a seemingly innocent and really likable character. A character much like herself is tested by an outside force. Now, she had this to say about Alice. My backstory to Alice was that she was an art student. Art major, psychology minor. She had gotten her job through a friend of a friend who knew Steve Christie. He obviously had the hots for her, and who knows, maybe at the end of summer something would have happened, but he was going to have to be patient, and he didn't seem the patient type. One of the more interesting things I found watching this movie back this past week was a strange interaction between her and Peter Brower, who plays Steve Christie. So I have to ask the question, is Alice a virgin? Now, the reason I bring this element up is because of the long-standing trope that the final virginal girl being spared of a grisly demise. Victor Miller, who wrote the film, had this to say about Alice's character. The reason the girl who didn't make love survive was that she was not distracted. It's not that she was more moral than the others. She just had nobody to make it with. I wholeheartedly disagree with this statement because the movie proposes both Steve and Bill as potential sexual partners for Alice. Or at the very least, you know, puppy love. So the tropes of slasher films were not really in play yet. You had your framework between Halloween, Black Christmas, and this film. But the whole idea of the morality play, I don't know that it was necessarily in play yet. This revelation begs the question, is Friday the 13th a movie about moral consequences? Now, before you or I answer out there in the rant army, Adrian had this to say on the subject. I don't believe Friday the 13th was a morality play. She smokes weed. She plays strip Monopoly, although she doesn't get naked. So there's hints that she's not really the, you know, typical librarian, you know, no sex kind of girl, but there's also nothing overt to her to make her a whore. So I don't know, you may be able to read into those kind of things that maybe there's more of a morality to it than there perhaps is on the surface. I'm not sure. I'll leave that to you guys out there. Critics have been harsh on slasher films for their portrayal of female characters, you know, being little more than fodder for the killer to stab them with sharp instruments, aka a metaphorical penis. Friday the 13th, at least part one, doesn't hold up to this scrutiny because of its female antagonist, which leads us to Betsy Palmer, who plays Mrs. Voorhees. Now, aside from her murderous role in Friday the 13th, Betsy is best known for her role as Virginia Bullock on 29 episodes of Knots Landing, very popular show in the 1980s. She also starred opposite of Peter Fonda, Jack Lemmon, and James Cagney in 1955's Mr. Roberts, and in Queen Bee with Joan Crawford the same year. So she's no scrub. She had a very fine career on television doing game shows as well. So she had this kind of, this whole layer of Hollywood glitz and glamour that I don't think a lot of Friday the 13th fans really, really even acknowledge or understand. Fast forward to 1979, and, you know, Betsy was in need of some fast cash. She hadn't done a movie in a while, and she needed a new car. So when the opportunity to make Cinemax history was presented, she took it. She just didn't necessarily realize she was going to be making cinematic history. She had this to say about accepting the role in Friday the 13th. My agent called and said, "How'd you like to make a movie?" "Great. I had not done a movie in years. California?" My agent said, "No. It's going to be shot in New Jersey. And it's 10 days work. Make $1,000 a day. But there's a catch. It's a horror film." I said, "Oh no. It's bad enough that I'm known for game shows. Ah, I've got a secret," I said. "Send me the script." He sent it to me. I read it. And I said, "What a piece of shit. No one's ever going to see this thing. It will come. It will go. That's the end of it." I called him and I said, "I'll do it. And that's my part of the story." Man, without Betsy Palmer, I don't know that this film works. Screen legends Shelley Winters and Doris Day were both considered for the role. Estelle Parsons was best known for 1967's Bonnie and Clyde was actually cast as Mrs. Voorhees, but she had to drop out because of scheduling reasons. You know, all things considered, I can't help but feel things turned out for the better by casting Betsy. Man, the revelation of her in this film, albeit her screen time very, very little, she makes the most of every second she's on screen. And I don't know that this film would work without her. The payoff is almost the entirety of the film. Sometimes, you know, it's the journey, it's not the destination. And that definitely works the first time you watch it. But without Betsy Palmer as Mrs. Voorhees, this movie doesn't have replay value beyond Tom Savini's kills. And I'm just calling a spade, that's just the way I see it. You know, Betsy's time as the killer is short-lived, but when she's beheaded by Alice on the shores of Crystal Lake, whew, man, one of the most iconic moments in history. The effect, Tom Savini's assistant, Tasso Stravakis, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, has a dummy on his shoulders and he's kind of hunched down, and you get that awesome shot of Alice whipping the machete across, and it just, the head flips. It was actually attached with some toothpicks, so it would hold it in place. And he knew that because Tom's actually one swinging the machete, he swung it and it would flip the head and cut through them, but very dangerous in retrospect. But there's this awesome shot, or some may not say awesome, because of some very hairy knuckles. Her hands come up into frame and she's grasping for, like, where's my head? Those knuckles are going to come back in discussion a little later on in the episode concerning a theory some fans have as to whether or not there may or may not be multiple killers in this film. All right, guys, in an effort to be transparent, gotta let you know, I fucked up. I fucked up in a big way. I'm listening back to the podcast, editing it, getting it ready for your old waiting ears, and I realize I left out a really important story involving myself and Betsy Palmer. So I figure I'll interject that right now into the show. So several years ago, before my endeavor into the world of podcasting, I had a syndicated article in a newspaper called The Mountain Press called Welcome to My Nightmare. Kind of think of it as the foundation or building block, the prototype of what this podcast became. And I had done an article about one of the anniversaries of Friday the 13th. In particular, I believe it was part 3, but that's not really important to this story. So, a few days pass, and I get a memo from my editor saying that this gentleman named Shane Marr, who had a studio here in my hometown of Sevierville, Tennessee, would like to meet with me. And I'm thinking, like, what the hell? You know, maybe I'm ready for the movies or whatever. And it just so happened, I meet with him, and he told me about this film that he had made called Bell Witch, the movie that was shot in the area. It was one of the first high-def camera films that ever made. I mean, the thing was shot entirely digitally. And it just so happened that the voice of the Bell Witch in his film was none other than Betsy Palmer. So instantly, I'm thinking, like, oh my god, this is my chance. I'm going to get to interact with Betsy Palmer. And that's precisely what happened. He set up a phone interview. Her and I talked for, God, probably over an hour. And let me just say, Betsy was full of life. I mean, even her elderly state at that point. But yeah, she jabbered and jabbered and jabbered in like the best way possible. It was just like talking to your grandmother, you know, just 1,000 times better because, you know, she was in Friday the 13th. So she regaled me with all these stories. And out of the blue, several months had passed, and I wrote another article talking about Betsy's involvement and a documentary about her that Shane Marr had made called Betsy Palmer, a Scream Queen Legend in Her Own Words, which is the only way I can equate it. It's sort of like what wrestling fans would call a shoot interview, where it's just her talking about her life and her career. And it was really interesting. So I wrote a review both about her involvement with Shane Marr and this documentary, and I get, out of the blue, a handwritten letter from her and an autograph. And it's the cornerstone and prize of my entire collection. And I have autographs and props and all these wonderful things in my collection, things I hold dear to myself, you know, that will be burned so no one can have them when I die. But the handwritten letter from Betsy Palmer is by far the most precious thing that I own. And I have an autographed poster of Ghostbusters, so let that sink in. As big a Ghostbusters fan as I am, this is the cornerstone of my collection. Even beyond that, every once in a while, I would hear from Betsy, you know, just asking, like, how I'm doing. Just very cordial, nice lady kind of stuff. And that's all possible because of, A, working at the newspaper in the media, and B, because of Shane Marr. So I want to give a shout-out to him, and I want all of you out there who maybe have a narrow viewpoint of Betsy Palmer and would like to expand upon the really interesting life that she led, you gotta seek out this documentary. You can find it on Amazon. It's called Betsy Palmer, a Scream Queen Legend in Her Own Words. And you can also find that film that he made. So if you'd like to see the last couple of projects that Betsy worked on before she unfortunately passed away, well, she did them with Cinemar. One little extra detail. And when I was allowed to interact with her and have this phone interview, I was told there was one thing I could not ask her about, and that was because she still had sore feelings about a relationship she had with one of the most iconic Scream legends of all time, a gentleman by the name of James Dean. She dated James Dean, was his live-in girlfriend for 2 or 3 years, and I was not allowed to talk about this. And man, I really wanted to. So that's my story about Betsy Palmer and the inner workings and the relationship that her and I had. And now let's get back to the show. Our heroine, Alice, pushed to the point of madness by beheading the murderous Mrs. Voorhees. Ah, she retreats to a canoe and falls asleep out on the lake, but there is terror lurking below. To go back a moment to Harry Manfredini, Harry had this idea that you would only hear music in the film, with the exception of some banjo getaway music when they're coming up in a truck. But, you know, when there's actual score in the film, that was to let you know that the killer is lurking. So you had been conditioned to this, but all the music, you know, very Bernard Herrmann-esque, you know, lurking and gloomy and doomy, ominous. And finally, Alice is out on this lake, and you have this beautiful, you know, orchestral swell, and your expectations were absolutely subverted, because this amazing, amazing ending, oh my god, Jason erupts from it and pulls Alice under the water. This scene, in of itself, has scared me more than any other film moment in history. And I have been lucky enough to have been in the viewing of this film with people who had never seen it before. I saw this at the Tennessee Theater several years ago on Friday the 13th. It was an awesome experience. I was there with my girlfriend. She had never seen the movie. Now, she was one of those people, oh, Jason. And the whole time she's like, where's Jason? Where's Jason? And then finally, when he jumped out, she fucking hit the floor. And half the audience did too. And I'm like, almost dumbfounded. Like, how did people not know about this ending? So it's almost like the best kept secret of something that everybody knows. It's a weird paradox. You know, this amazing ending, admittedly, was lifted from Brian De Palma's Carrie and was suggested by none other than special effects wizard Tom Savini. He had this to say. You know, in talking with Sean about the ending, we really didn't have one, but I just seen Carrie. You know, in Carrie, they did this beautiful job. Brian De Palma convinced you the movie's over, so I said to Sean, why don't we have Jason jump out of the lake? You know, attacker. But Jason's dead, he said. And I clearly remember that, you know. If it's in a dream, you can get away with anything. The ending of Carrie is really good. Carrie is actually in my top 10 favorite films of all time. Here's the difference between the ending of Carrie and the ending of Friday the 13th. The ending of Carrie, Brian De Palma, an amazing director, he shot the whole scene in reverse. And it's almost like there's like a gel on the lens, maybe like Vaseline, to give it a really soft, dreamlike quality. So even though maybe fans in 76 or whenever the film came out maybe weren't as savvy to realize that the jump scare was about to happen, the context clues are still there. Friday the 13th is fucking out of nowhere. Now, even though, like, he had conditioned you to realize anytime music was on screen, the killer was there, he still subverted that by not having ominous music. So effective. I can't say enough nice things about this ending. It's amazing on levels that are unsurpassed by most modern and films that preceded it. The conclusion of Friday the 13th serves both as an ending and a beginning. An ending to Mrs. Voorhees' murderous rampage, but also as a beginning for her son to avenge her death. Now, albeit a small role, Ari Lehman emerges from the depths of Crystal Lake to pull Alice below its dingy waters, causing a blood-soaked wave that continues to this day. Number one, I have to say, thank you so much, Ari, for giving this that awesome intro at the top of this episode. I've actually met Ari. He's very personable. If you ever get a chance to meet him in a con, he will talk your ear off. He'll tell you stories, you know, ins and outs. And he's also in a really awesome band, First Jason. So if you like stuff that's like maybe a little bit in sort of the gore, but a little more punky kind of category, he's kind of a mixture of punk and metal. And he plays a guitar, but it's made to look like a machete. It's very corny, but in the context of an awesome stage show, it absolutely works. So I can't say enough nice things. However, I do feel like that Ari maybe gets overlooked as Jason. You know, there's a handful of, you know, the actors that people really single out as being their favorite, you know, Kane Hodder and C.J. Graham, Derek Mears and on that line. But to me, Ari is the only one who's really scary. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you see that and you're like, absolutely not. But if I was going to get a tattoo of Jason, and trust me, I've thought about it, and I actually came close at one point. But if I'm going to get a tattoo of Jason, I think I wanted something different. And you never see little kid Jason. So if I'm going to adorn something from Friday the 13th on my body, it's probably going to be Ari. And Ari, if I get that tattoo, you will be the first person to know. Now, the cast of Friday the 13th, it's a mixed bag of credible actors and infamous bodies left in the Camp Blood massacre. So let's go down the list. Robbie Morgan, who plays Annie. Now, the first two kills in the film, the prologue, you see camp counselors Barry and Claudette, played by Willie Adams and Deborah Hayes, respectively. They're dispensed rather quickly, but the film's first noteworthy and gruesome kill is of a character named Annie. Annie, Robbie, rather, she doesn't have a ton of acting credits, but she does hold the distinction of having her throat slit via the special effects skills of Tom Savini. This is super realistic, especially for the time. You get to see the wound open up and the blood pour out, and oh, it's just so visceral. But yet again, those hairy knuckles come back into play. So when you see this, it's obviously a man doing it. And this has led a lot of people to think beyond the celluloid and kind of fill in gaps because how is Jason dead in the first movie and alive in part two? Is this actually Jason doing this? Could this be Jason's father, whether that be Elias, who I think in canon now is actually married to Mrs. Voorhees, but wasn't actually Jason's father, vis-a-vis the video game, whether or not that's canon now, I don't know. But it is an interesting thing to think about. Now, they did a really cool comic adaptation called Pamela's Tale. I think it was IDW, or maybe it was Wildstorm, one of those independent companies. I've got it. It's two issues, and it tells the story of Pamela and Jason's back history prior to the first film, and it's through the lens of the scene where Mrs. Voorhees picks up Robbie Morgan's character of Annie, and they have that conversation in the Jeep. I don't know. Annie was a very nice character, but I could also see her getting a little grating had she not been dispensed rather early. So she almost serves as the Janet Leigh kind of character, where you almost think she's going to be the main character, but then when she's killed off, you're like, wow, you know, nobody's safe. I think that's something that's sort of lost in film today, and I don't, even when it's done, I don't necessarily think it has the impact. So it hadn't been done to death at this point, I guess was the point I'm trying to make. You know, before we move on from Robbie, she has an IMDb credit that I was kind of interested in, but it's not for acting, it's for stunts. She has a stunt credit on IMDb for The Great Outdoors, with stars Dan Aykroyd, who was in Ghostbusters. You just got busted again. So, of course, I had to mention that because, number one, she's a tiny little girl. Stunts. And connection to Ghostbusters. So, there you go. So, let's move on to Janine Taylor, who plays the role of Marcy. Now, Janine has one other acting credit. But, you know, she had this to say about not pursuing an acting career. Frankly, I didn't think I was pretty enough. I wasn't tall and blonde. I didn't even think of myself in that way. So, she didn't pursue acting, which is really sad because I think she's really good in this film. And it just makes me angry. The 80s was, and the 70s, was a golden time, especially in like low-budget horror movies, for casting men, women, girls, you know, that looked real. They looked like the girl next door. Janine Taylor is fucking smoking. I would kill to find a girl that looked like that. And for her to fill those constraints is kind of harsh. Now, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, I need to be represented on screen and everybody needs to be blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, obviously there are characters that should be, you know, above and beyond, you know, physical and attractive. But I think in horror films, when you have an unknown cast and they look like a girl that you know, it lends itself to a more reality rather than it being, oh, look, it's Jennifer Love Hewitt or Sarah Michelle Gellar. Yeah, the 90s. Fuck them. Hot! Don't get me wrong. I definitely wouldn't kick Sarah Michelle Gellar or, you know, fucking what's her name, out of my bed. But I'm just saying, save the slasher films for really, really attractive, nice-looking girls. Her acting career may not have been long, but her death scene is cemented in the hallowed halls of horror infamy. So, she has this awesome scene where she's just had, you know, relations with her boyfriend Jack, and she retreats to the bathroom and is going to take a shower. So, she's, you know, looking in the mirror, and she starts hearing noises, and we get this awesome shot of an axe clipping a light, a real axe, and then you don't even get the impact. You just have the reaction shot of it in her head. Savini has a wonderful way in his films of making props feel real. It's where you use a real implement and you have them take a chunk out of something, like in The Burning, which he did the year later. Cropsey comes in with these shears, and there's these shots where he's just like clipping into the canoe or a boat, whichever it is, and chunks of wood are coming out. So you know those are real, but then when Fisher Stevens' fingers get cut off by the prop, man, it just it has so much weight to it. And this kill, God, seeing this with people who've never seen it before, I think this may be the most suspenseful part of the film, is the lead up to it, because they know it's coming. But the way it pays off, it's just so impactful. So my salute to you, Janine Taylor. You will always have my affections of having one of the best kills in horror history, and for being pretty nice on the eyes as well. You can't talk about Marcy without talking about her beau, Jack. Not BoJack Horseman. Her beau, named Jack. Kevin motherfucking Bacon. Now, much like Tom Savini, I could talk for hours about Kevin's body of work, but let's hit the highlights. For the sake of context, Footloose, Tremors, Apollo 13, Wild Things with Bill Murray, who was in Ghostbusters, You Just Got Busted Again. Booyah. Even though, you know, he was early in his acting career at this point, most of his cast and crew realized he was destined for great things. But it was seen as somewhat of a coup to get him in the first place, considering his small and yet rising star. Casting director Barry Moss had this hilarious pitch to Kevin's agent to get him on board for Friday the 13th. He had this to say, "I remember when I called his agent to see if he would do Friday the 13th. The agent said, well, what does he do in the film? I said, mostly, he just makes love to a lot of girls. And his agent said, well, Kevin loves to do that. The rest, as they say, is horror movie history. And in the intervening years, Kevin has notoriously distanced himself from Friday the 13th, much to the chagrin of horror fans. You know, like it or not, Kevin Bacon holds the distinction of having one of the top five most influential kills in horror movie history. Now, despite his reluctance to associate himself with Friday the 13th, he did have this to say about his death scene. "They built a fake neck and chest. I was crouching under the bed for hours. My head was sticking out through a hole. It was absolutely awful. But I did have a classic horror movie death, which is, you fuck the girl, you smoke the joint, you're dead. So that was good. Arrow through the throat." With the exception of the ending, probably the most iconic moment of this film. To this day, one of the best kills ever in a slasher movie. And I guess some of that has to do with just the fact that Kevin Bacon went on to become, you know, an Academy Award winning or is nominated. I'm not exactly sure, but I mean, definitely an A-list actor of television and the big screen. But you know, divorce yourself from that, just in of itself, man, what a hell of a kill. So fucking memorable. And yet again, seeing this in a theater with people who've never seen it before, whoo, motherfuck. That the second that blood drops down from, because, you know, Ned, spoiler, is he's up in the top bunk and the blood splashes down and you see what's supposed to be Mrs. Voorhees' arm come up from under and the arrow come through. Oh, so fucking good. You know, his standoffishness, I don't know if that's a word or not, towards Friday the 13th has subsided somewhat in more recent years. In fact, in 2014, he reprised the role of Jack among many of his other signature roles in a commercial for the company EE Mobile Network. Now, a lot of people haven't seen this commercial because it only aired in the UK, because of course it fucking did. God forbid we get a Friday the 13th character in a commercial in America, but you can track it down on YouTube. I think it's a fun watch. Kevin holds the distinction of being one of many A-list actors whose career were launched from low-budget horror films. So let's just name off a few. Johnny Depp in The Nightmare on Elm Street, George Clooney in Return to Horror High, Jennifer Aniston in Leprechaun, and Leonardo DiCaprio in Critters 3, among many others. Now, not all the cast members of the film have had the career in acting that Kevin Bacon has had. Harry Crosby, for instance, who plays Bill, hasn't had an extensive career in Hollywood, but he did grow up around the glitz of the entertainment industry, being the son of Hollywood legend Bing Crosby. Wow. As in Little Drummer Boy with David Bowie, Bing Crosby, for my generation. Younger generations probably know him from Family Guy, Cutaway Gags. I'll use my ring hand. But aside from that, I mean, come on, that's pretty cool that Bing Crosby, son, you know, the poster child for moral goodness was in this sleazy, dirty slasher film in the 1980s. So fun. Bill's death may be off screen, but not only kicks off the third act of the film, the final act, but it serves to eliminate him from consideration as the murderer. One of the more interesting things they do with Bill, among other characters, is they kind of play coy with who's the killer. And he has this shot where, and truth be told, he actually kills a fucking snake. The snake is real, and they killed it on screen, which absolutely would not be done today. PETA would fucking go nuts. In fact, I'm kind of surprised that there isn't a big, you know, online campaign to ban this movie, you know, after the fact. But there's this shot of him after he cuts the head off of the snake in the bunkhouse, and it just kind of holds on him, and the machete's slumped on his shoulder, and it just holds on him just a second too long. So you've seen, like, he'll kill, but will he kill humans? I think that's interesting. I don't think it really works, especially after the fact. I kind of equate Friday the 13th as being, in a sense, kind of like Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes, one of the greatest endings ever, but once you rewatch it, I mean, you see it, you know it's coming. It doesn't exactly have the same impact. So watching this film for the first time and not being cognizant of there even being a whiff of Jason, I'm just curious, you know, people who saw it back in the day, if they thought that Bill was going to turn out to be the killer. They definitely didn't play their hand that it was going to be Betsy Palmer, so I guess he would have been as good a candidate as anybody else. I think they went in the right direction with it being Betsy Palmer. I'm just saying, for the sake of a red herring, you know, Bill's not too bad of a character. Another character that you may remember from this film is Laurie Bartram playing the role of Brenda. Unfortunately, Laurie tragically passed away at the young age of 49 from pancreatic cancer. Her untimely death is only made more tragic by all of her cast members gushing over how nice and full-spirited a person she was. Adrian King had this to say about Laurie. Laurie Bartram, we miss her so dearly. She was truly the heart and soul on the production. She was who you saw, you know, worried about everybody. You know, it seems like much of her natural personality shows through in her performance as Brenda, but eternally, her cinematic claim to fame was to be the inventor of Strip Monopoly. I don't know about you out there. Monopoly is a long, long, arduous game. Play Monopoly online and, you know, with friends from time to time. Not entirely sold on the idea of playing Strip Monopoly. It seems like it would end pretty quickly for somebody, and then you're just sitting around with your balls swinging the wind. But for the purposes of a movie, definitely something memorable that this thing has going for it, as opposed to, you know, like some of the things that happen in the later sequels. But nobody actually gets naked in it, so that's a huge strike against the movie. I can't stress this enough. You gotta have nudity in slasher films. God damn it. Thank you, Marcy, Janine Taylor, for showing them titties off. Brenda's death is off-screen, but she does make a splash when her dead body is hurled through the window at Alice. Now, a fun fact, it's actually Tom Savini who performed that stunt. There's a quick cut, like she comes through the window and then it immediately cuts to an insert of Laurie Bartram. But after rewatching this, knowing it, and yeah, it's pretty obvious, her body mass is just completely different size. So, you know, special effects comes in many forms. I didn't realize that stunts, you know, that is a low-budget movie. Tom Savini, cap off to you, my friend. Our next character on the list, Mark Nelson as Ned. Now, Mark is still a working actor. He's had many roles on things you've probably heard of. First Wives Club, Certainly Susan, Law & Order SVU, Spin City, and The Good Wife. Ned is my favorite character in the film. But the Joker usually gets killed off in these films. but they can at least give him an on-screen death. I think he's the most likable character, and he has the most personality out of anybody, and his death reveal, it does serve a greater purpose, but come on, I know it was a low-budget movie, but you could have given him something a little more than just, you know, off-screen death. We want to see those deaths on screen. Our next character, and fuck, you know, what I just said about Ned, fuck it. This is actually my favorite character of the movie. Maybe my favorite character of the entire series. Walt Gourney as Crazy Ralph. Crazy Ralph plays a very important role, a very small role in this film, and was unfortunately killed off in part two, which is absolutely a mistake. They should have kept him. He should have been a through line through as many of these as he was up for doing. But he has an important role as a soothsayer. Soothsayer being the character who brings news of forebodement that something bad is going to happen. He also serves as another character who potentially could be the one killing all these. Alright, conspiratorial shit again. There's a lot of people out there who believe that he may be Jason's father. He's crazy. Mrs. Voorhees is crazy. Maybe he doesn't even realize. Maybe he does realize, and that's why he's telling him, like, listen, fuck, my wife is, or ex-wife or whatever, is killing people out here. Let's get this shit, stop it, you know, let's make this shit go away. I don't know. That would be a bummer, especially if you find out in part two that, you know, Jason kills his father. Maybe he wasn't a good dad. Maybe he was having some separation anxiety. Like, why didn't you come to my birthday, Dad? Fuck you. But I don't personally hold that assumption. Walt had a great acting career. Everything from the remake of King Kong to Trading Places, which, yes, by the way, Dan Aykroyd was in, who was in Ghostbusters. You just got busted again. He passed away in 2004 at age 91. He lived a very full life, and what an awesome cornerstone to have, you know, your acting acumen. He was an iconic character in a slasher film who's not a killer. That's pretty interesting in of itself. One of the most memorable characters in any horror film ever. My salutes to you, Mr. Gourney. Our additional characters. We have Rex Everhart playing Enos the truck driver. Ron Carroll playing Sergeant Tierney. Dorothy Cobbs as Trudy. She's the woman in, like, the general store at the very beginning of the film. Sally Ann Golden as Sandy. She's the lady in the diner who serves Steve. Ken L. Parker as the doctor. And cult actor Irwin Keyes has an uncredited role as a busboy at the general store at the very beginning of the film. You've seen him in tons of shit. Probably a lot of people in this generation might recognize him from House of a Thousand Corpses. He's in Sid Haig's, you know, or Captain Spaulding's Murder Ride Museum, whatever. Phew, man. I don't know about you, but after that rundown, I sure could use a drink. So let's drink it in, man. Friday the 13th edition. So what you're going to do, if you're so inclined and would like to watch the movie with a little bit of an alcoholic twist to it, I'm going to lay out some scenarios for you. And every time these occur, take a shot of, you know, your particular favorite, you know, alcoholic beverage. Take a drink every time you see the killer's POV. Take a drink every time you hear a kick, ma, ma, ma. Man, you're getting there. Take a drink whenever the film fades to white, which is interesting in of itself because I don't remember any other horror film ever doing this. Now, I think they stopped after the third or fourth film doing this, but it was still a hallmark of those early Friday the 13th films. Fade to white, very unique. Take a drink whenever you see the Camp Crystal Lake sign. Oh, yeah, you're getting drunk. And take a drink whenever there's a jump scare. Yeah, do drink responsibly. Do not drink and drive. Make sure you are home, parked your ass on the couch. Well, I don't know why you would be watching a movie in the car, but fuck, people have smartphones now. So don't drink and drive. For those of you out there who take your drinking seriously, our friends over at Secret of the Booze on YouTube have concocted the perfect Crystal Lake cocktail. So if you want to drink something that's going to tie in a little more with your sensibilities of this film, make it a little more fun. This would be fun for like a viewing party if you have cool friends. I have a couple. So what you're going to do is you're going to take a shot glass, fill it halfway full of vodka of your choosing. Fill the rest of the shot glass with rum chata. Now, you're going to take a larger glass. I think, what are they called? Yeah, you know what they're like a brandy glass or a whiskey glass. And you're going to take it, put it on top of the shot glass, and you're going to flip it over. Now, if you do this correctly, the contents of the shot glass will not leak out. Now, you're going to take 2 ounces of blue raspberry mix, and you're going to pour it in there. You're going to take the shot glass, you're going to pull it out, and this is going to make a really, really nice, murky blue color raspberry rum chata vodka mix. So, voila, Crystal Lake cocktail. I haven't made this yet, but it's definitely going to be happening. And had Fad Fuck Scott showed up to do this podcast with me, we might be making it right now. So we'll definitely have to be taking a rain check on that. But I think it sounds good, so I invite all you out there who drink responsibly to have a crack on it. Let's do a little bit of general trivia for Friday 13th. The movie was filmed at an actual Boy Scout camp in New Jersey called Nobby Bosco. Filming began on September 14th, 1979, and lasted 28 days. Sean's son, Noel Cunningham, would have been Jason in the film if it had not been for the objections of his mother. By the way, Noel Cunningham still butthurt about this, and understandably so. He could have been one of the iconic, you know, figures of horror of all time, rather than just being the son of the director of an iconic horror series. But such is life. Gene Siskel of Siskel and Ebert hated the film so much that he gave away the ending in his review in an effort to deter people from seeing the film. Now, he and Roger Ebert also slammed Friday the 13th on their television show during a segment called The War on Women, which focused on misogynistic slasher movies. This tastic boosted ticket sales, much to their chagrin, which was good despite their efforts, but Gene Siskel went over the line by publishing the abridged address of Betsy Palmer and encouraged people to write her letters condemning her for being in the film. Now, I've mentioned my disdain for Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel plenty of times in this podcast. Being a critic is not a heinous thing, but what they have done is, now, I'll be the first to admit that I had incorrectly attributed this to Roger Ebert, because I remember seeing clips of this show, but it actually was Gene Siskel in his review in the Chicago Daily Times or one of those papers that actually did this and gave away her address. That's what we would call in modern times doxing. Fuck you. And I know he's dead and you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead, but I can't help it. Fuck you. You sniveling little piece of shit. You did nothing with your life of note. All you did in your life was bitch about things. Fuck. Now, I've said it once and I've said it 1,000 times. Fuck Siskel and fuck Ebert. You know, to call Friday the 13th sexist is one thing, and if you douchebags were still alive, I'd gladly debate the sexist elements of the series, you know, part one beyond. But one thing I just can't seem to let go concerning their reviews of the series is just an incorrect viewpoint that is perpetuated by people who don't know any better to this day. And that is something that, like, even fans of the series will say. Like, every Friday the 13th film is the same. Rant alert, because you're about to get schooled. So let's talk about the Friday the 13th series evolution. I know this is diverging a little bit from part one, but I do think it's important because this narrative is so egregiously incorrect. Friday the 13th part one is a murder mystery. And it has a female antagonist, a female killer. That in of itself is different from not only most of its contemporaries, but just different movies in general. Usually it's a man. Part two, you have a new killer. Different. Part three, it's not only do you introduce the hockey mask, but it was also shot in 3D. Part four, you have a child protagonist. That was taboo then, taboo now. And you killed Jason. Part five, it's an imposter. Part six, resurrected Jason. Also, you interject elements of comedy. Part seven, your protagonist has psychic abilities. Part eight, you take Jason out of Crystal Lake and move him to Manhattan. Now, albeit some of that is on a cruise ship, but it's still different. Part nine, body hopping. Jason X, it's in space, and you have, you know, Uber Jason. Freddy vs. Jason, you pit him against one of the other biggest horror icons of all time in Freddy Krueger. And then you have the remake. The one film that Roger Ebert gave even a halfway decent review to, being that he said, it's no worse than any other Friday the 13th film. And it's the only one that doesn't do anything different. Now, yeah, you can nitpick that, and there's little things. But broad strokes, no. There's nothing different about it. And I'm not even hating on the movie. I know I've made my point in the past to say that it's, you know, somewhere towards the bottom for me, but I won't discourage you from enjoying it on its own merits. So, let's wrap things up. We've got a few fan questions I want to get to. First of which comes from Zach McKenna. What did you all think of the special effects of the film compared to others from the same year? Before I answer that, let's go down the list of horror films that were released in 1980. This is a truncated list. The Shining, The Changeling, John Carpenter's The Fog, Motel Hell, Cannibal Holocaust, Prom Night, Altered States, Dario Argento's Inferno, Terror Train, Maniac, Christmas Evil, Mother's Day, New Year's Evil, The Boogeyman, Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill, and ever-loving fuck-ton of others to boot. Maniac has great special effects, because yet again, that was Tom Savini. Great exploding head scene in that. Altered States has got pretty good effects, but man, they're not on the same level. I just think that the special effects and the practical effects in Friday the 13th are just heads and tails better than most movies for at least for a year. And then, you know, in 1981, you've got this slasher movie boom, and there's a lot of talent that came out of the woodwork. But even then, man, Savini was doing the best stuff. So Savini gets my vote. So yeah, Friday the 13th, best of 1980, at least that I can think of off the top of my head. This comes from Kayla Mays. Where would you rank the original Friday the 13th among the rest of the series? Friday the 13th is not a perfect film. It has a lot of pacing issues. A good chunk of it could be cut out. It's, like I said before, it's shot in a utilitarian fashion. Not a lot of visual cues that make it visually appealing to look at. But I still think from a historical context and just a personal preference, I'd probably put it somewhere in the middle. Higher end of the middle. You know, top four. And I realize that a lot of people don't enjoy this film because it doesn't have Jason as the killer. And if that's your cross, you know, to bear, then, you know, walk on by. But it's not mine. I gotta say, having a series of films without Jason is an interesting direction, but it's one that I hope that doesn't happen, but I'm still glad the first movie exists. It's a very unique and not entirely paint-by-numbers slasher movie. And of course, Titty Flip and Travis leaving us with one final question about genitalia. How shriveled is Jason's corpse penis after being in the water all those years? I'm assuming pretty. If it's even there, fish may have bitten it off. Not entirely sure. Oh, God. Ren Army, I don't know about you, but I feel like our luck is running out, so we better close up shop before Mrs. Voorhees comes a-knocking. But first, I gotta just, let's just surmise Friday the 13th as best I can. It's a movie that has been with me all my life. It's a movie that will be with me, you know, till the last breath leaves my body. Every time I upgrade televisions, it's the first thing I watch. Why is that? I don't know. It just feels right. But the ending is so iconic. The effects are stand out above and beyond a lot of stuff you see now. It was just a moment in time that'll never be replicated. And whereas it's not the best of the series, it's definitely the jump-off point for everything that great that happened afterwards. And, you know, a debate point could be made. You know, it's Friday the 13th, not Halloween, that spawned every slasher that came afterwards, because money talks and bullshit walks. I want all of you out there in the Rant Army, or in those of you who are not and who are listening for the first time, to follow us on social media. Subscribe to the podcast on one of the many platforms we're available on, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio, and don't forget to stop by our homepage at juicykruger.com. And for the love of Cthulhu, buy some swag at our online store at rantarmy.com. All right, Rant Army, till next month, keep marching.